Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 16th, 2006. Our session today is entitled A Journey to the Earth's Core. Our session leader is Steve Grimesh. Session number GRS 2006-03. Let's listen in.
Good evening, everyone. After our lengthy discussion yesterday, what I want to do today is go back just a little bit and kind of hit a couple of points. You got a hall pass? I want to back up a little bit because we rushed through some things and I kind of skipped some stuff that I wanted to really mention that's kind of important actually about this debate. Today I don't foresee us engaging in any kind of lengthy discussions about intelligent design or things like that. What I'd like to do is save that for Friday and put it in the context really of what can we do, sort of how should we lay out an argument, or not an argument really, but a statement of what the beliefs are and how science and faith can work together, because that discussion doesn't go on, and I think it could. But the reason I have this up here right now is that somebody who was sitting here yesterday mentioned that Avicenna was also involved in advances in psychology when he was working on his medical efforts when he was a young man. And so I thought that was pretty interesting. So another sort of feather in the cap of a guy who really made a difference. So let's fast forward here to, not fast forward per se, but okay, so yesterday what we did was we kind of introduced the idea of flood geology as part of creation science, and the idea now is that creation science is not a term that's used very much anymore because it's a bit inflammatory, and the people who are proposing these kinds of entries into the public school curriculums are not interested in conflict, really, I don't think. I think they want to sort of do it under the radar. And so terms like intelligent design have been used to replace creation science. I think in the beginning they thought it was a great idea, creation science, we're going to get it right out there. But I think they realized that the public wasn't ready for that yet. So anyway, I'll remind you that the common aspects of flood geology or creation science in general were a belief in the Bible or a use of the Bible as a source of scientific information. This is something that mainstream science obviously rejects wholeheartedly, but that the sort of creation science community does not. They feel like it's valid and they take as the literal truth the words that are written. Of course, those words are subject to interpretation, and I guess that opens up a whole other can of worms. But the other issue is a timeline as laid out according to Genesis. This is a little bit separate from the source of scientific information, but it's still related. But what this gives us is a young Earth perspective, something where the Earth is now on the order of 6,000 years old, and anybody who has any kind of thinking along the archaeological lines knows that that's virtually impossible. But anyway, we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so what we talked about yesterday was the idea of the origins of flood geology in the 17th century, preceding a little bit the formal development of geology as a science in the mid-19th century with some work that was done by the Reverend William Buckland at Oxford University and also Hutton and Lyell. Now, the other point I want to make and just reiterate a little bit about this was that Buckland was, even at this late date, even at, you know, the point of the mid-19th century, was still saying, yes, we need to use science as a vehicle for understanding God's creation. And that turns out to make our faith richer and our science more purposeful. Of course, he's talking about it from a religious perspective, but he still maintained that religious perspective, the same religious perspective that Plato had on his science when he was in his Timaeus. Okay, so... okay, now one of the things that I want to point out here, the flood geology revival took place at the beginning of the, well into the 20th century here, with a couple of books, the latter one in 1961, so that's fairly recent. And the Institution for Creation Research was founded and is still going strong, founded by a guy named Henry Morris, who's still very active in creation research type of causes. As a matter of fact, one of my colleagues, Bob Hazen, from the Geophysical Laboratory, was excoriated by Morris in a magazine called Elements, which is put out by the American the Mineralogical Society of America, along with a couple other societies in Great Britain and Canada that having to do with the earth sciences. And this magazine has a sort of a thematic type of format, and it's not a scientific journal per se, but a very sort of high-level weekly or monthly magazine for the earth sciences. Well, the first issue of this just so happened to have the topic, the origin of life on earth. And so they just wanted to get it right out there at the start. Anyway, Hazen and a couple other of my colleagues at the Geophysical Lab wrote articles for this talking about the current state of research in this area. Anyway, if we're interested in inflammatory statements, let's read here. If the system of flood geology, this is attributed to Morris, by the way, if the system of flood geology can be established on a sound scientific basis, then the entire evolutionary cosmology, at least in its present neo-Darwinian form, will collapse. This in turn would mean that every anti-Christian system and movement would be deprived of their pseudo-intellectual foundation. Evolution has served effectively as the pseudo-scientific basis of atheism, agnosticism, socialism, fascism, and numerous faulty and dangerous philosophies over the past century. That's actually mild for Morris. He gets a lot of airplay for some reason. Anyway, a couple of things that we want to point out. The flood geology, again, as it takes as its starting point or its first principle, the literal existence of a great flood. And so the hallmark of flood geology are cataclysmic processes that can take place over 1 year. According to the Bible, the landforms that were created, as most of the landforms as we see them, were created as the floodwaters receded after it rained for 40 days, and then the water swelled up for 100 more days. The waters receded after a year, and all these things happened. And we talked a little bit about that yesterday. But I will say this, that the they are willing to ascribe long-term processes, long meaning hundreds of years, as opposed to what we term geologic time on the order of many, many millions of years, and in many cases, billions of years. Once again, it's the young Earth hypothesis. They're forced to fit in to a very, very short period of time events that mainstream science considers to be taking place over millions and billions of years. And we'll talk about those in a second. But let's one cautionary note here is that currently it's it's becoming more a part of mainstream science to identify episodes of catastrophic behavior on the Earth. Things, you know, massive flooding, not worldwide flooding, but evidence in the fossil record of flash flooding, sort of the kind that would be produced by tsunamis. There's a couple of people that started with this in the 30s and 40s who were roundly criticized by mainstream science and really because they thought that episodic catastrophism was a religious point of view, and it just was not accepted. Now it's becoming more accepted as our methods of analysis are becoming more and more sophisticated. So, unfortunately, some people had their careers ruined by this. They were doing great work, and it just wasn't accepted into the mainstream, which is very unfortunate because it's added to the scholarship. So, if you're inclined to read more, make sure that you identify the difference between periodic catastrophic type of events, earthquakes, floods, things like that, and opposed to cataclysmic processes that take place, you know, over a single year that are purporting to be responsible for things that we consider to take place in geological time. Okay, so the flood geology revival. And what I'd like to do is just go over briefly a couple of things we talked about. We talked about, you did ask me to do the calculation, and I did do it. The flood mechanism that we talked about yesterday, the vapor canopy model, remember, is not a part of the model according to flood geology anymore. It was originally thought that the atmosphere would hold all this water, and that it would, and sort of a conservative calculation would be that it would have to be at 9 atmospheres pressure and about 600 degrees Fahrenheit in the Earth. There's no evidence in the geological record, and the flood geology community was forced to withdraw that claim. They couldn't reconcile it with the young Earth theory, simply because there was no evidence. And I will say this, that the flood geology community does look at the evidence. They do. They look at they're not trying to fabricate evidence. They're looking at the evidence. They're doing scientific work with that evidence, although the problem is that they're a priori trying to fit it to a predetermined time frame. That's why it's difficult. Okay, so, but the feature that still remains is the crustal fissures that released trapped water. So all this water was stored inside the Earth, and the Earth opened, and all this water was released and flooded the land, the entire Earth. Now, yesterday, I don't want to be difficult, but yesterday I mentioned that it's recently been discovered that there are an abundance of hydrous minerals in the mantle. We're going to be looking at a lot of these diagrams today, so I hope you like them. But what these represent here are water molecules that are absorbed onto, structurally bound to crystalline matter in the mantle. And so what we've discovered at the geophysical lab is that these hydrous minerals in the mantle, based on the abundance that we feel is there, could presumably hold approximately 3 oceans worth of water in the Earth's interior. Of course, that begs the question, well, what if it ever got out? There's absolutely no geologically accepted mechanism for that water to actually reach the surface as liquid water, but it's still there. It is. At least that's what we believe at this point. And evidence points to the fact that there is a huge amount, 3 times what we have on the surface of the Earth in the oceans. Okay, so yesterday, somebody asked me to do this calculation. Well, what if this three oceans worth of water suddenly came to the surface of the earth, how deep would it be? So, I did it. Now, don't break out in hives or anything, but you asked for it, so I did it. Now, there are a couple of very, very large assumptions in this. One, I will mention them as I go along. So, we take the circumference of the Earth to be 24,000 miles around, which is about right. And so if you solve for the radius of the Earth, you get a radius of 3,821 miles. I know my significant figures are not, I've been a bit liberal with them, but I think you'll see what I mean in a minute. Okay, so no problem there. Okay, so if we do that, then we calculate the volume of the Earth. This is a nasty, nasty number, but I forgot the formula for the surface area of a sphere, so I had to do it a little bit less elegant way. Still, I think you got the right answer. So the volume, 4/3 pi r cubed, gives us 2.3356 times 10 to the 11th cubic miles. All right, that's huge. Okay, that's 2.3 and 10 more zeros after it, so it's huge, right? And a cubic mile, remember, is a square mile multiplied by a mile in height, right? A cubic mile. So that's how much the volume of the Earth is based on that formula. Are you taking notes here? No?
Math 101.
Thought about paper.
Somebody lend him some paper. Might help you when you get back to school. Okay. All right, so the volume of the lithosphere, that is the volume of everything else besides the water. Okay, so what did I have to do? I had to make an assumption here that on average, the oceans are a mile deep. Now, of course, they're much, much deeper in other places. They're not nearly a mile deep in many places. And so I looked at the atlas in the library there last night and kind of did a quick sampling. And I thought, okay, let's just assume that the oceans constitute a mile deep. Now, of course, what I'm neglecting here is the volume of everything above the surface of the water on the land, which is significant, but I think I don't think the answer is affected too much by that. Okay, so the volume of the lithosphere, let's take the radius out to the lithosphere as 3,820 miles, so we get a new volume. The volume is, you compare these two numbers, it looks like they're pretty close, right? Doesn't it?
Yeah.
They look very close, right? So what that's telling you is that the oceanic contribution is pretty small, okay? So, all right, well, that's the ocean. And when you think about it, you talk about the Earth being 3,821 miles, into the radius, into the center of the Earth, this 1 mile, or so, doesn't seem a whole lot. Okay, but even if it was 2 or even 3, it wouldn't change the result that much. I think you'll see that in a minute. Okay, so we've got that. The volume of the oceans, now, if you subtract those two numbers, this is a very basic, sort of straightforward, back-of-the-envelope calculation, and it doesn't include everything that I should include, but I don't have all that info at my disposal. Anyway, you subtract those two numbers, you get 0.0018 times 10 to the 11th cubic miles. 70% of that is the water. Okay, so what that means is so the volume of the oceans, according to this very rough calculation, is 130 million cubic miles. Now, the 1 mile seems small, doesn't it? 130 million cubic miles seems big. And the reason is because what happens is when you calculate the area, you square the radius. And so it gets very large very quickly. 130 million cubic miles worth of water on the surface of the Earth. Okay. So the volume of water stored in the Earth's mantle, so this, that number there times 70% gives this. Three times that gives 390 million cubic miles inside the Earth's mantle. That's huge. Okay? All right. So the next thing would be, whenever I do something like this, I'm always reminded of a story I heard in graduate school that there was this guy that came in to give a seminar in the physics department, and it was purely mathematical. And so he's up on the, and it's like not PowerPoint stuff, okay? It's chalkboard stuff. And so what this guy did basically was sit up there at the chalkboard for 50 minutes and derive things. Well, there's one guy who is famous in the department there. He'd retired like, 30 years ago, but he was still attending the seminars. And he would sit there and he wouldn't say a word ever, and then he would just start to tear the people apart. So everybody would be afraid of going to these seminars, to give them. But anyway, this guy was interviewing for a job and he had to give the seminar. So at the very end, he comes up, to the end, and he said, "Wow, it worked." Which is probably not a good thing to say. He said, "Wow, it worked. I'm really surprised." He was really, really happy. And he said, "That means I didn't make any sign errors, like plus minus sign errors." And the old man sitting there said, "No, you made an even number of sign errors." So, which, who knows whether it was true. It might have just been mean. But anyway, I don't think I made any sign errors. Okay, so the new volume of the Earth post-flood, let's add the volume of water stored in the Earth's mantle and let's let it come out onto the surface. And the new volume of the Earth post-flood now is just this thing here plus the previous volume of the Earth. So now we've got 2.3369 times 10 to the 11th cubic miles as a new volume, okay? So that's like the second line there added to that last line. Okay, so the new volume. So it's big, right? This is the new thing. It's added on to the volume now. It's all up there. Okay? So the new Earth radius, we would have to set this thing. Okay? Got it? We're going to set this thing equal to 4/3 pi r cubed and solve for r. What is the new radius? That's what we're going to get. What is the new radius of the Earth? It turns out that the new radius is 3,822 miles, not 3,822 instead of 3,821, like you see at the top. So the conclusion is the increase in the ocean height is 1 mile. Now that is what we call a lower bound. And the reason it's a lower bound is because what I've neglected is the displacement of all that water by whatever is above sea level on the Earth. Okay, so it's just not going to lay on there flat. There's other things that are there, and so it'll actually be somewhat higher than that. I have no idea how to calculate the volume of the lithosphere above sea level.
It's been calculated. Someone knows that number.
It's probably out there somewhere. I have no idea how to calculate it, and I'm not sure where I find it. Yeah.
We know from experience in the past that when you withdraw substances, fluids in particular, from deep below the Earth's surface, that there's then often subsidence or collapse
right.
of some sort.
That would be another thing.
So it might be that although you're adding more volume of water above the surface, with the collapse inward, that in fact the effect wouldn't be a mile.
Yeah.
It's not mathematical, but,
Well, right. I mean, it's certainly, I don't know that those effects would cancel completely, but I think it's probably definitely a point. Yeah. But anyway, so let's say it's about a mile. Okay? I think that's kind of a nice result, don't you?
Yeah, for those living in Denver.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So the bottom line is, if this water ever got out, we would have some big problems.
That's what they said.
So, yes, that's the punchline.
Except for Denver, they're a mile high.
Yes.
Right.
Everybody else that isn't a mile high and have to be swimming.
Right.
We just have to move to the
other. And that would be, right, I mean, there would be, the Earth would be a very interesting place to look at if that were the case, because you'd have many, many mountains that are, you know, quite high. You know, that's what it would be. It would be, you know, who knows, maybe it looked like that in the beginning.
When Noah sailed to Denver.
What's that?
When Noah sailed to Denver.
Oh, right, yeah. Who knows, maybe we'll find the Ark in the Rocky Mountains or something. So, neglected in this model, as I said, with the volume of the lithosphere above sea level and, as just mentioned, a settling effect that would take place if the water was suddenly eliminated.
Now,
okay.
Just one other thing. I think Mount Everest is, what, 2 miles above?
Yeah, something like, well, no, I think it's more than that. It's like 29,000
feet. 29,000
feet. Yeah.
It's how like much is less than 3 miles, though, right? Somewhere
no, it's like about 6 miles.
Like 6 miles.
Over 5 miles.
Over 5 miles, because...
Yeah. 5 miles, okay, right.
Right, so...
So we're only going to cover a small part of the Earth. It's not going to be a whole Earth flood.
Right. No, it would not be a whole Earth flood.
That's
no.
The key.
No. Yeah, right, yeah. Now, I can assure you, that my colleagues at the geophysical laboratory who are working on this problem will not be trying to make anything out of it beyond just the fact that it's part of the Earth's water budget. And some of this water gets cycled through the mantle by various convective processes, which are important. But the mechanism for them to come to the surface in a complete sort of, I don't know, deluge type of way, it does not exist. Okay, so anyway, that's that. I rushed through this really fast, and please interrupt me if you have any questions about this.
Sure.
I just wanted to give you a couple of important points about the processes that have to be considered if you are going to adopt a young Earth type of viewpoint. Now, and the first one of these is the sedimentary rocks. It's extremely important. 80% of the Earth is covered with sedimentary rocks, and we've all seen those sedimentary rocks. And the basically, the accepted mechanism, both by the flood geology community and the mainstream geology community, are that these are deposited, these sediments are deposited by running water coming over the land. And so what you see here is if this sort of sedimentation and subsequent lithostatic pressure is going to squeeze these things into rocks, chemically speaking, if this goes in 1 year, all these sediments are laid down in 1 year. What you're going to find is you're going to find mixing in between these layers. But I think if you've gone through areas where there are sediments and sort of these bends and folds and things like that, you will see quite clearly that they are rigidly defined. There's a little mixing here and there, but they're pretty rigidly defined. I mean, within like less than a centimeter, they're rigidly defined strata. If you had this happening over a year, you would have significant mixing in between those layers, and they would not be nearly so well defined. Again, this is the time problem. It's not that the flood geology community is saying this doesn't happen. They're saying that it takes place over a much, much shorter period of time, a period of time that is unacceptable according to physical reality, laboratory experiment, verifiable results. Another thing that has to do with this sedimentary rocks is the fossil fuel formation that takes place underneath sedimentary rock. So again, the flood geology community accepts the fact that you have decaying organic matter, and then at a process of chemical reduction, lithostatic pressure, and very high temperatures, you have a degradation of the matter and a separation into many fractions. Now, if this is taking place over the period of, let's say, you know, several thousand years, this degrading and this temperature sort of type of mechanism, the simple fact is that there's not time in several thousand years to develop the kind of temperatures that are required in order to degrade this matter and produce those many fractions of oil that are found in other products that are found deep in these strata. Yeah.
You can actually go in the lab and measure the reaction rate,
mm-hmm.
and the reaction rate and the temperature effect on the reaction rate. So
right.
It's not a question of not being. It's not possible to do this time plan because you can't possibly get it. The reaction rates are well known.
Right. If you do the calculation, if you do the experiment, then what you find is these processes are taking on the order of 50 to 60 million years, not 6,000. Okay. Once again, it's the time problem. Okay. That's the central feature. Okay. The last and probably the most important is radiogenic isotope dating. And as I said yesterday, you have a certain fraction of carbon-14 in any living system. When that living system dies, the carbon-14, it's produced at a steady state. Okay, so every one of us in this room has the same basic fraction of carbon atoms in our body that's carbon-14. When we die, then that carbon-14 stops being produced and it starts to decay away at a very predictable rate. It's very well known. It's 5,730 years for this amount of carbon-14 to decay away to half of what it was before. That's called the half-life. And so we've taken advantage of that in a number of many studies to date things. And so you just calculate how many half-lives have passed by how much is left. How many half-lives, and then you get your answer. Most people are familiar with the Shroud of Turin controversy that was finally solved by radiocarbon dating when the caretaker of that shroud allowed somebody to take one thin strand of it. And it turned out that the shroud was made in the 15th century. So that was a bummer. But, you know, I was kind of hoping, but, you know, it's okay. So the other issue surrounds, so dating rocks is a much more problematic issue, but it's the same basic process. And the oldest rocks on the Earth that we've found, the oldest rocks are, in fact, meteorites on the order of 4.5 billion years. And that is very well defined. I mean, the age of the universe is precisely known by the oldest meteorites that we have.
Is that the age of the universe or the age of the solar system?
Solar system, right, sorry, yeah.
So there is no way that the Earth could have been born like 6,000 years ago, it would have to be born.
October 23rd, 4004.
But that meteorites are extraterrestrial, so
yeah.
What's the oldest Earth dating for rocks?
About the same.
About the same.
Okay. About the same, right. I mean, the age of the universe is roughly at about 5 billion years old. That's extrapolating from the data. I mean, it's not precisely known. That information is not precisely known. Yes, thank you for correcting me on that. Okay, so again, radiogenic isotope dating is extremely important, but again, it's the time problem. Now, of course, we have dated artifacts from civilizations which are older than 4004 BC. So one would think that appears to be the nail in the coffin of flood geology. Well, there's two responses on the part of flood geology. A, that all the premises surrounding the calculation of radioactive isotope dating are false because the speed of light has changed from over the past 6,000 years. So these data are no longer, they don't represent what we think they represent.
Has it gotten faster or slower?
I believe it's required that the speed of light has gotten slower.
I haven't heard that.
Yeah. That's, I mean,
it's quite.
Well, what the problem is that's kind of like the soft response. The hard response is, well, those dates are all wrong, that the archaeological methods that are used are dating it completely wrong. They're much younger civilizations than we say. So, you know, that's pretty disturbing, actually. So, anyway, again, what are we talking about? We're talking about the time problem, aren't we? We're talking about a space of time. Events that take place over many, many billions of years are having to be squeezed into 6,000 years. Even less than that, because, you know, the landforms that we know have been around for at least 2,000 years, at least 3,000 years, whatever. I mean, according, if you're taking the flood geology perspective, you have to know that all these things are there because of the Bible story, right? So, anyway. Okay, so the upshot of all this, I think, is that in terms of science, what's the problem? Yeah. What's the problem here, scientifically?
Time.
Well, yeah, and what you're doing is you're saying, okay, you're trying to fit your data to an a priori model, right? That's the problem. You can't, here, they do not have the freedom to let the model evolve into what it's supposed to be, what the data would show. Everything has to be fit to that model. That's not scientific.
So they have an answer to each one of those. When you say when you give each one of those examples,
yeah,
they have a counter example. They say, no, that's not true because, even though it
usually has to do with God.
God didn't let it happen that way.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, there's a fundamental problem when you try to use empirically based science to analyze and judge a belief system, which is really.
Oh, of course. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, well, anyway, so I apologize for rushing through all this yesterday. I hope we've got to the point. All right, now what I want to do with the rest of the time we have is to take you through a journey to the Earth's core. And what I have up here is kind of a cartoon of what we view in the Earth science community as the structure of the interior of the Earth. And again, please interrupt me with any questions you might have. But I'm going to take you through a tour of this from my point of view and some of the work that I do. Okay, so I think most of us are aware of the basic features. You have a crust that's very, very thin compared to the rest of the radius of 3,821. Good. Okay. A for the day. Very thin, varies a lot over the oceanic crust is tends to be a little bit thinner. The lithospheric crust tends to be greater, but in any case, you have a very thin sort of the analogy that we like to use is an orange, and so that you have the orange peel, not a real real thick orange peel, but sort of a thinnish orange peel. Okay, so then you go into a region of the upper mantle. All the processes that we observe. Not all, but most all the processes that we observe here on the surface of the Earth, like these mountains out here, are mainly crustal processes. There are some mantle processes that we can observe, volcanism, for example, but most of the processes, the folding of the mountains and things like that, may have been generated in the mantle, but they're crustal processes that we observe. Okay, so then you have the upper and lower mantle. Then you have what's called a D double prime layer. Don't ask me why it's called D double prime. I think, you know, somebody famous was up late and decided to call it that. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But anyway, this is very, very important because this is where you have what's known as the core mantle boundary. And what we're going to see in a few minutes is that this is where a lot of iron cycling takes place. And so this is a very, very active region of the interior of the Earth. And then, of course, we know that there's an outer core and an inner core. Now, what we have discovered, really, over the last 50 years or so of work in this area, when our seismic instruments have become more sophisticated, computer modeling techniques have become more sophisticated, and also laboratory measurements of high pressure and high temperature have become more sophisticated, we're getting a view that the interior of the Earth is a very, very dynamic system. It's not static. The same problem, I mean, we adopt the doctrine of uniformitarianism, that the same processes have been taking place over many billions of years. However, that the story, the history of the Earth is one that's constantly evolving. And the interior of the Earth is, from the point of view of chemistry, of physics, of biology, in the crustal area, is extremely rich. Okay, so let's take our first dive into, I knew I was going to do that too. Let's see, how do I do that?
Previous.
You got to do that right. Totally uncoordinated. Can somebody go there and hit the the up arrow button there?
Do you have cap lock on?
No, I don't think so.
Cap lock doesn't really matter with up arrow.
Help.
I thought it did. You don't want help, you want to go below help.
I'm not on L, I'm on the arrow keys over the lower left.
Just click OK.
Click OK.
Oh. All right, so now could you just use the up arrow? There you go. Thanks. Okay, so the crust, the thin skin. Now, I'm going to be talking about these diagrams. Now, what I want to show you, so this is kind of the simplicity, the complexity, the simplicity argument that I advertised. Okay, so if you, and I'll talk about how we get this data in a minute. If you take a look at a rock, you pick it up off the ground outside. If you take a look at that rock is going to have on the order of 6 times 10 to the 23rd units of this type in that rock. Okay? That's basically the scaling factor that we use from what we call the atomic level, which is this. Now, each of those little spheres there represents an atom of one type. In this particular case, we've got a mineral called serpentine, magnesium, silicon, oxygen, and hydrogen in a very specific chemical formula. That's the definition of a mineral. It definitely has to have a specific chemical formula. Rocks, on the other hand, are mixtures of minerals that don't have any necessarily fixed composition. Not necessarily. Some do, some don't. Now, experimentally, we can take a crystal of serpentine and we can do an experiment to find the exact positions of all of those atoms in that crystal. The crystal is going to be on the order of a millimeter at most when we do the experiment. I'll explain the experiment in a second. Okay, so what we have here, this turns out to be extremely complicated from the point of view of geology. And what we've done is developed ways of simplifying the picture. So if you take a look at your various types of atoms, for example, some you will find have this what we call tetrahedral arrangement. How many of you remember the tetrahedron from the Platonic solids on the very first day? Right? Tetrahedron was one of the Platonic solids that had the element form. Anyway, another one was the octahedron, the Platonic solids from your geometry class in 10th grade. Yeah? Yeah? Right off. Okay.
I'm in the 10th grade yet.
Okay. Well, you'll be way ahead.
Closer than we are.
Okay. So, anyway, what you see here is an array of these types of polyhedra. Now, the red atoms are oxygen. In all these diagrams, the red is oxygen. And they've been removed. So what this thing is showing you, this is a silicon atom surrounded by four oxygens. This one here is a magnesium atom surrounded by six oxygens in this polyhedron. Okay? And again, this is the mineral serpentine. It's a common crustal mineral, and it's a result of processes that take place in crustal rocks. If any of you have ever been to a place called the Cedars in Northern California, you'll in Sonoma County, there's a huge, huge serpentinized rock, which and this turns out to be, if you remember your high school chemistry, turns out to be very basic. It's so basic that carbon dioxide is grabbed from the air and immediately turned into calcium carbonate in the water. Serpentine is an extremely interesting system. But anyway, the point is that you have structural units here that, remember this now, this is the take-home message. Silicon is tetrahedral with four oxygen atoms around it in the crustal rocks. Okay, next. So let's go down. And there's many, many, many types of crustal minerals. I mean, it would, you know, there's been volumes and volumes written about all of it. I just wanted to show one that shows the sort of the salient features of crustal minerals, and that is their very, very complex array of atoms. Okay. All right, so how do you ask we get this information? We do an experiment called X-ray diffraction. Now, this is not the kind of X-rays that you sit in front of at the doctor's office in the emergency room. These are what are known as our hard X-rays, which are not absorbed by crystalline matter, but they are what we call diffracted by crystalline matter. And so X-rays of extremely high energy are shot through the crystal and are scattered onto a photographic plate. And so that photographic plate gives us information in what's called a diffraction pattern. And this diffraction pattern is mathematically reconstructed to give what we call a crystal structure. Mathematically, we can take this information. There's many types of information in this, but I'll talk about two. One is the symmetry of the pattern. The symmetry of the pattern gives the symmetry of the crystal. And then the intensity of the spots on the diffraction pattern, I've just given two different ones here, but in practice there's hundreds of different intensities on the same pattern. But what that does is then tell us what atoms are there. So, what atoms are there and how they're arranged, all that information is mathematically reconstructed to give what we call the crystal structure. Now, as you might imagine, this is a computationally intensive affair. The first crystal structures were done on sodium chloride in 1912 by two guys, a father and son, who both won Nobel Prizes. It's pretty cool, I thought. But that was the start of what we call X-ray crystallography. And it took them several years and many, many, many of these pictures to analyze what they had in their tiny crystal of sodium chloride, which turns out to be one of the simplest crystal structures that there are. So anyway, this crystal structure is quartz. It's the most common rock-forming mineral on the Earth's surface or in the crust. And what you see here, once again, is this tetrahedral, or what we call four-coordinate. Four oxygen atoms and all these tetrahedra are linked, giving quartz its amazing properties. It's a fascinating system. Beyond just, you know, you could walk out there on the street right there and probably 95% chance that any rock that you pick up is going to have quartz in it. That's how pervasive quartz is. And we're going to see some interesting things that happen to quartz in a minute. Okay, so there's the X-ray diffraction experiment. Now, in 1912, this experiment took years to do. At this point today, with computer technology, we can do probably in 10 minutes what it took them years to do, just because of the mathematical reconstruction of this information. But see, that's science. having the computer and making making it easier to do this job is technology. And I'll tell you what, the old timers who did it all by hand, they knew their crystallography and they knew it really, really well. And I wish that I had the resources or the opportunity to do one like this, because you really learn it. But what science, this is the thing, okay? Science is understanding that you can take this information and get that. That's science. And that, to me, is just beautiful. Okay, that's why I love this field so much, and that's why I work in it. Okay. Okay. Upper mantle, let's dive now. Okay, so there's two very common minerals that take that are in the upper mantle. One of them is garnets, typically seen in volcanic rocks. This is a particular variant that's storing water. But again, what we see is the same type of elements: magnesium, silicon, oxygen, hydrogen, we see again, but not necessarily the randomized sort of layer type of arrangement that we saw with serpentine. Here you can see all those structural units, the same ones that we saw before, but these structural units now are packed. And they're packed because now the weight of the crust now is pressing on these things in the lower or the upper mantle. This is probably the most common mineral in the upper mantle. It's known as olivine, magnesium, iron, silicon, and oxygen. What I want you to pay attention to here is, again, silicon in its four coordination, or it's surrounded by four oxygens. Notice how packed these things are now. Okay? And the other thing is that there's two separate types of sites for magnesium and iron. In practice, the iron and the magnesium are all scattered all over those sites. Okay. All right, so that's the, and what we're talking about here now is about 400 or so kilometers down to the upper mantle. Can you hit my up button again, please? I'm sorry. It's like, okay. All right, lower mantle now.
Am I in the right one?
Up one. There you go, lower mantle. All right, now what we see in the lower mantle, it's a very, very large region of the Earth's interior. And what we see now is an increasing role of high pressure and high temperature. Pressure does two things. It squeezes things together and then orders them. Okay? The temperature also is a minor effect. I mean, we're all taught to believe that temperature is the big deal on the interior of the Earth. It's not. Pressure is what's really, really making things go here. In terms of energy that is supplied by pressure, probably on the order of 100 times more influential than temperature. Okay, but notice what you have here. You have an ordered set now of these magnesium and iron octahedra. Okay, your pressure now has started to bring things together, squeeze them together. But look, we still have silicon in tetrahedrons. All right, but in certain cases, now with the mineral stishovite, which is also found in the lower mantle, you have the oxygen atoms squeezed so tightly together now that you have six coordination. You have, instead of tetrahedra, you have octahedra now. So, and this stishovite was first found in a meteor crater in Arizona. So actually, the impact of the meteor, it turns out to be the meteorite if it falls, right? So the meteorite now has crushed the silica in those rocks into what we now called stishovite, after its founder, Stishov. The guy's very interesting, but very eccentric. He had all kinds of offers to come and work in the United States. I met him several years ago, but he just doesn't want to leave his home in Russia. Yeah. He just doesn't want to leave there. Okay, so anyway, Stishovite was a really big deal. It was discovered about 40 years ago. Okay, and Stishov is still around, by the way. Okay, the D double prime layer. Okay, now things get really interesting. The D double prime layer, you see how these things are getting simpler now? The structures are getting more organized. The same elements are there, right? But now instead of olivine or Wadsleyite, now what we've got is simpler structures. This one is called perovskite, after its founder, Perovsky. And the perovskite now I'm simplifying it a little bit, but basically magnesium, silicon, and oxygen get together into this structure now, and then it kicks out some magnesium oxide and iron oxide. This is the mineral called magnesiowustite, which is iron and magnesium oxide. Notice now, we've got cubic minerals. The pressure and the temperature are getting together now to squeeze these things together and order them. And the temperature kind of makes things all kind of nice and smooth. So, it's pretty interesting. The balanced chemical equation, for those of you who care about such things, is up at the top. Magnesium, iron, silicon oxide, which was olivine or Wadsleyite, is now separated into these four mineral types, and that's what we're finding now in this area of D double prime. Yeah?
How do you find them there?
Yeah.
Is theoretical instructions, or?
No, actually, we have created a device known as the diamond anvil cell. And what we can do is we can recreate those temperatures and pressures in the laboratory by putting our mineral samples in the cell, squeezing it to that pressure, and then it's just an Allen wrench. You know,
pressure is determined by calculations of...
The temperature is determined by a pressure standard that's inside the cell that we can calibrate.
But, I mean, how do you know that it's the same pressure as the...
Oh, well, that we know very accurately the pressure at depth from the size of the Earth and its moment of inertia and all the physical properties and the density from seismology. So we know what the pressure is. We know absolutely what the pressure is because we can measure the speed of sound through that, which is the absolute pressure determinant. Yeah, that's a good question. Anyway, we do an experiment in what's known as the diamond anvil cell. And the pressure is created by static pressure, and then the temperature, we use a laser.
How do you know what temperature
you use? Again, we can, well, what we know is we know the profile of temperature as we're going down. And basically, we can infer pressure. This is much less well determined.
It is inferred.
Well, yeah, we can't measure it. But what we know of is laboratory simulations or experiments based on things that have come up from specifically diamonds and inclusions in diamonds. We can observe what's in there, and then we can sort of do experiments in the laboratory to understand what the temperature must have been when those things were formed. And so we have a pretty good temperature profile, but it's much less well-defined. Yeah, temperature is dicey, but we have probably within maybe 200 to 300 degrees uncertainty, we can know what the temperature is at depth. So that's not too bad.
Are these minerals stable then once you release the pressure?
No.
Okay.
No, once, magnesium oxide is.
Okay.
I mean, that's easy, but perovskite will not be. That composition will not be stable in what we say it will not be stable in the perovskite structure if we release the pressure.
Yeah.
Right. So again, a lot of this has to do with matching seismology data to a model that we create, and so we sort of refine the model in sort of a back and forth between theory and experiment. But the point that I want to make here in terms of complexity and simplicity is that these materials are becoming more and more simple as we go down. And now, of course, the punchline, you'd expect it to be the simplest of all, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? Right. There it is. Iron. Nice. Packed. And based on our experiments, what we know is that we know what the depth of the liquid outer core is because the speed of sound goes to zero when it passes through a liquid like that. It's just the seismological signal just goes to zero. And so we know that it's not actually the speed of sound, it's what's called the shear wave. But anyway, the shear wave goes to zero, we know exactly how thick this is, and by extension, we know exactly how thick the inner core is. The inner core is a solid iron nickel alloy. Based on our observations in high temperature experiments and high pressure experiments, and it has a little bit of nickel in there. It has to. And the nickel, and then there's one other lighter element in there. It might be sodium, it might be hydrogen, it might be oxygen, it might be sulfur. We don't know. But that's okay, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, it's okay. It's okay. You know, it's fine. We're working on it. It's good, you know?
It could be a mix of those, right?
It could be. It could be. The problem is that we know that the core is, by and large, solid iron. And, I mean, look at that. Isn't that beautiful? That's what we call hexagonal closest packing. We call it the epsilon phase of iron because there are a number of different phases. And this is very, very simple. You might think, well, okay, why is it liquid out here and solid in here if the temperature's going up?
Pressure.
Exactly right. The pressure overtakes, so if you look at, the pressure overtakes it at some point. If you look at a graph here, this is a very simple graph of energy as a function of depth. Now, it's more complicated than that. But basically what's happening is the energy of both materials, solid and liquid, are going up as we go in depth. Temperature and pressure are both increasing, so the energy goes up for both. However, at some point, the energy of the solid becomes lower than the energy of the liquid. And that is what we call the inner core, outer core boundary. That's where the material is much more stable as a solid. And so if it's more stable as a solid, what's it going to do? Turn into a solid. And that's what we call the phase transition from liquid to solid. Okay? And so we know pretty well that the inner core is about 360 million atmospheres of pressure. Just so you're calibrated, if you dive into a swimming pool and go down about 10 feet, you're looking at about 1.2 atmospheres. So this is huge. 360 million times the pressure of the atmosphere at the Earth's surface.
How do you know where the boundary lines are between the different layers of the underground Earth?
Well, what we do is we have data from two sources. We have data from seismological studies from the Earth's surface, and we can send a wave through and get it on the other side, detect it. And so we can measure the speed and how it changes. Okay, so as it gets to the other side, it carries a memory of what it's been through. Okay? And so there's a seismic station over there, there's a seismic station over there. We send two waves. We send what's known as a compression wave this way and a shear wave that way. And we time them to see when they get to the other side. And then the information that they carry tells us that they've gone through places of different density. And we can, based on the time it's traveled, we can measure the distance.
Wow.
It's cool.
Yeah, it must have taken a long time to get all the preparation for it.
It's big time, yeah. It's a lot of work. The other information that we get are from earthquakes, especially what we call deep focus earthquakes, which are deep in the mantle, and they send their shock wave up to the. But at bottom, what is an earthquake? It's nothing more than changes in the crystal structure of minerals. changing, volume changing, occupying more space, pushing against something else, and then ultimately propagating that shock forward.
How deep are the deepest earthquakes, and do they happen in the core?
Not as far as we know. The pressure is too high in the core to really do anything to that. What's really interesting now, though, is there's a current view. Sorry, Lynn. Okay, we're about 5 minutes over, but the current view is that the core could be rotating in its liquid outer core. And what that's giving rise to is changes in the magnetism that is observed at the surface in rocks and in fossils. Sort of there's a big effort in the field, what's known as paleomagnetism, and sort of trying to reconstruct a rotation of the Earth's magnetic field, sort of a what we call a precession of the Earth's magnetic field, could be due to its the core of the Earth floating around in there. It's a little kind of weird, you know.
Imagine you have the middle of your
Earth. I think it's cool.
Yes, possibly. Right. Yeah.
What's the consistency of the inner mantle? It's probably not homogeneous, but then is it mostly solid or mostly?
It's all solid.
It's all solid.
Yeah, we find absolutely no indication of any liquid matter from the crust to the inner core.
So
for seismology.
Then how do we get magma?
Well, right, but we were talking about a very, very small vein of, I mean, in terms of the whole mantle, you're right, it is liquid, but it's surrounded by, you know, this solid rock.
I see.
And, yeah, I mean.
So the normal state is more of a solid rather than.
Right.
But the outer mantle is viscous, it moves.
But it is solid. Right, sure, it's not viscous.
It wasn't viscous, we couldn't have convection.
That's true. But it's not a liquid
yeah.
viscosity. Right. Anyway, so that's all I had for tonight. I hope you enjoyed it. And, you know, you're not going to look at, you know, hopefully you won't look at the Earth the same way again. You walk out there on the Earth and you're walking on some good crystal stuff.
Those deeps in the earthquakes, are they like 60 to 80 miles?